WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The eradication of smallpox was one of the greatest world health victories in history, but now we are faced with the possibility that smallpox will be used as a terrorist weapon. Health policy experts have been debating if, when, and how to begin a new program of vaccinations. On Friday, the nation's top public health officials, including the directors of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, recommended a vaccination program that would first immunize up to 10 million healthcare workers and then make the vaccine available to the general population. The final decision is up to the president. It is unlikely the vaccine will be licensed for general use until 2004. My guest, Richard Preston, is the author of the new book, The Demon in the Freezer, about smallpox and anthrax, their history, and current scientific efforts to thwart them if they are used as bioterrorist weapons. Preston is also the author of the bestseller The Hot Zone about the Ebola virus. He has won the American Institute of Physics Award and the Center for Disease Control's Champion of Prevention Award. Preston has written for The New Yorker since 1985. I had a slightly different attitude reading this book than reading your first book, The Hot Zone. In The Hot Zone, I thought, God, this is so fascinating. And I was so, the descriptions of the Ebola virus and what it did to the human body. I remember when I interviewed you, you described it, and I thought, wow, this is really interesting. Reading similar kinds of descriptions in your new book, but this time about smallpox and anthrax, I'm scared in a way that I wasn't scared reading the Ebola book, because I figured my odds of getting Ebola are pretty small, but my fears of biological warfare are greater. So I'm wondering, like, when you were writing this book, was it more difficult for you to immerse yourself in this material?
Well, I have to admit to you that I'm more scared of smallpox than I am of Ebola virus. That was the case always for me. When I was researching the Hot Zone, I went to Africa and I went inside Kitum Cave, which is in East Africa, which is thought to harbor one of the strains, types of Ebola virus called the Marburg virus. And as you can imagine, my wife was not terribly pleased that I was going to this cave, but I felt that with the right kind of biohazard gear, I would be all right, and I was. The problem with smallpox is that it, unlike the Ebola virus, it is finely tuned to attack the human body. In fact, this virus cannot live successfully in any other organism except Homo sapiens. And it is considered by doctors to be the worst disease in history. And it is very much, I feel, it's a kind of a personal threat. It's a life form that knows us and loves us in a way and longs in a biological sense to return to its natural host. It is sitting in, supposedly, in two freezers, illegally, one in Russia and one in the United States. There may be more than one freezer in Russia. It appears that there may be military labs in the Russian Federation that are secretly working on smallpox today. But in any case, one feels that the virus is very much more personal, and I feel in a way that I don't feel so much fear for myself personally, but for my loved ones.
When you talk to experts, how worried are they about the possibility of anthrax or smallpox being used as weapons?
The people who know smallpox are very concerned about it. I should say that professional medical doctors who have seen human smallpox cases and have worked with them have a very doctorly attitude toward it. And they are not always the ones who are the most concerned about it. Because in their experience in history, they were able to eradicate the virus with liberal use of the vaccine. Today, while we have a national stockpile of the vaccine, it's rather unclear whether it could be gotten into people quickly enough. The virus spreads very rapidly through the air. And there also is a great deal of concern that maybe with very simple genetic engineering tricks, it might be possible to make the virus evade the vaccine.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the research that you've done for the book. Some of the book is built around the researchers at USAMRIID, which is the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases. Just describe what this institute does.
Well, it's the premier biodefense lab in the United States, and it's a very interesting place. They have different levels of biosecurity. They have these places called hot suites or level four hot areas where they work with the really dangerous stuff. The scientists work inside bioprotective spacesuits. And those people there, they don't work with smallpox. Smallpox virus can only be worked with legitimately at one place, which is the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. But in the Army labs, they work with other viruses, and they work with viruses closely related to smallpox, such as monkeypox. Those people, the ones who think professionally about biodefense, those people have a different attitude toward smallpox than the traditional doctors who worked with it. I think they feel and see very clearly that there are a number of countries around the world that are looking very carefully at smallpox and recognize that it could well prove to be the mother of biological weapons, and that therefore it's dangerous.
Why is smallpox so lethal?
No one knows. The actual cause of death in a human being from smallpox is not known to science. It's amazing how little is actually known about the smallpox virus. That's because very little research has been done on it in modern years.
I almost hate to ask you to describe this, but since we have been lucky enough, or most of us have been lucky enough to never see a case of smallpox, why don't you describe what smallpox does to the human body?
Well, one of the interesting things about smallpox is that it's a shapeshifter of a disease. It doesn't assume any particular classical form in the human body. It has a number of forms, and different doctors have different classification schemes. It interacts in a very complex way with the human immune system, and that's why it shows its face in different ways in the human body. There is what is called classical ordinary smallpox, and I'll describe that, and then I'm going to describe an extreme form of the virus. In classical ordinary smallpox, you get an illness that's rather like the flu. You get a backache, and you get a sore throat, and you feel ill, vaguely ill, for 4 or 5 days. And you often develop a worried face, which is known as the worried face of smallpox, and it's a diagnostic sign to experts. But most doctors would be totally unable to recognize a person with smallpox when they're in this phase. However, they are contagious. And the back of your mouth will be may have small pustules or little tiny blisters in it, and you may be leaking the virus directly into the air when you speak. The virus can spread during this phase. Then on about day 5 or so, the skin erupts, and you develop pustules that are concentrated in the extremities of the body, in the face, the arms and legs, and somewhat less so in the trunk, but really the pustules can go everywhere. They are large, extremely painful bulbs of pus. If they merge into solid sheets across the body, that means the patient will probably die. That's known as confluent ordinary smallpox. Smallpox also assumes the hemorrhagic form, which is rather like the Ebola virus. The skin can remain smooth, but it darkens. It can slip off in sheets. And the patient can bleed from all the orifices of the body, as with Ebola virus. The eyes turn red with hemorrhage, and in some cases, the eyes actually the whites of the eyes turn coal black. This is from deterioration in the eye. If there's any sign of blood in the skin or anywhere in the body of a smallpox patient, that means the outcome is almost certain to be fatal. These bloody cases are almost always fatal. There is another form of smallpox, which is known as variola sine eruptione, which is a very mild, non-fatal type of smallpox that is highly transmissible. I mean, people can, if you have it, you may not know you're very sick, but you can give full-blown smallpox to people all around you, which is one reason why the virus is so dangerous.
Why is the virus so contagious? I think you estimate in the book that each person who gets smallpox gives it to around 10 others, so it keeps multiplying by 10.
The fact is that no one knows what the multiplier of smallpox is, and it's one of the great and important questions about this virus. And there is a big debate going on in the scientific community. The multiplier of a virus is the average number of people who catch it from one person. And if the multiplier is 4, 5, 10, 15, or 20, then the virus can multiply itself very explosively through human populations, can be very difficult to control, even with vigorous vaccination going on. We don't know what the multiplier of smallpox is in modern industrial societies. We haven't seen it much in hospitals. We haven't seen what it would do in shopping malls, in urban areas, in closed airspaces, and with air travel. We just don't know.
Now, smallpox had been eradicated. It has been eradicated, although we're worried that some terrorist will start it up again. But it has been eradicated. You've studied how that was done. Can you give us like a capsule version of the technique that was used to disseminate enough vaccine so that the virus was eradicated?
In my book, I capitalize the word eradication, and I use it as a proper noun because the eradication is one of the great achievements. And it was led by a handful of doctors in Geneva, led by Dr. D.A. Henderson, who's now a bioterrorism guru working for the federal government. And they used a technique known as ring vaccination around outbreaks. Whenever they identified the virus moving through a human population, they would swoop in, they would vaccinate everybody around the village where the virus had been seen, and in that way, they would create a kind of firewall of immune people all around the virus. And the virus would find that it had no further hosts that it could infect, and it would die out in that spot. Through about 10 years of intensive ring vaccination, they were able to eradicate the virus as a natural disease.
Why was some virus saved after the eradication, and what was the rationale for that?
I don't think there was a clear rationale for why the virus was saved. And Henderson and others have said to me, gosh, you know, we had an opportunity. We really could have gotten rid of those stocks around 1980. We could have done it, but they didn't. It was kept for research. People weren't really thinking about what could be done with the virus as a weapon. And meanwhile, we now know that, quite secretly, the Soviet Union and probably other countries as well had already seen the potential for smallpox as a biological weapon. And in the Soviet biowarfare program, they were beginning the effort of developing these enormous secret stocks of frozen smallpox virus, which could be used in ICBM warheads that were allegedly aimed at the United States. Where those warheads are today, the smallpox warheads, whether they've been drained, whether they've been sterilized, what's happened to them, or what's happened to the designs for those warheads, is simply unknown, as far as I can tell.
So that's a real wild card. That's something to worry about.
Well, you know, there are a lot of things to worry about. And I would remind people that smallpox virus has been around forever. It was only eradicated recently, and our ancestors lived with smallpox in their families. And this country was built by families that had experienced smallpox, and everybody knew it, knew what it was. And it didn't stop us from becoming what we are today. And it won't in the future either. During the course of researching this book, I ended up at the Army lab where they have the arm of a child, an American child, which is the child died of severe smallpox, confluent smallpox, probably in the 1940s. It's a Caucasian child, about 3 years old. We don't know whether male or female, just the arm. And I went into the lab and I handled the arm. It's safe now. It's completely sterilized. And I had a sense of what this virus looks like in a human being, and it was absolutely impressive. But at the same time, I recognized that this was a sight that we have forgotten, yet all of our ancestors knew it only too well.
My guest is Richard Preston. His new book, The Demon in the Freezer, is about smallpox and anthrax. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Preston. He's the author of the book, The Hot Zone, about the Ebola virus. His new book is called The Demon in the Freezer. It's about anthrax and smallpox, their history, their treatment, and the possibility of them being used as weapons. Now, there are fears of what the Soviets might have done with their smallpox and the new strains they might have been developing. You say it's also conceivable that Iraq could have gotten a strain of smallpox from one of the last epidemics in Iran and Iraq in the 70s, and they could have stored that and used that for the basis of weapons. Where did you first come across that possibility?
Well, this was pointed out to me by Dr. Richard Spurzel, who was one of the head biological weapons inspectors for the UN in Iraq. And he pointed out that the Iraqi government now has officially declared that it had a weapons of mass destruction program and a biological warfare program as early as 1973. And in 1972, the year earlier, there was a massive outbreak of smallpox in Iraq. And it left many hospitals and hospital labs in Iraq with frozen stocks of real live smallpox virus. The virus, I should point out, can be frozen indefinitely for up to 50 years without any apparent decrease in its potency. And Dr. Spurzel pointed out that it seems almost inconceivable that a nation that is embarking on a biological weapons program, and in 1973, Iraq was building biosafety level 3 containment labs, these are serious labs, that they would go around and ransack their country to get rid of all the stocks of smallpox that were in the hospitals all over the country. It's just inconceivable that they would have done that. So logically, one assumes that there are seed stocks of smallpox in Iraq today. Where they are and what is being done with them is not my knowledge. I don't know.
Now, you write that in 1994, the World Health Assembly voted to destroy all the stocks of smallpox, and they set a deadline for that destruction of June 30th, 1995. And then in 1999, the UN voted to keep smallpox alive for another 3 years until June 30th of 2002. Can you explain all those deadlines to us?
Well, there was a profound desire on the part of the eradicators of smallpox, D.A. Henderson and others, to have a public execution of the virus, to take all the public stocks and cook them in an oven. And this, they felt, would be a way to demonstrate to the entire world, for the United States and Russia to take the high ground and to say to the rest of the world, we can get along fine without smallpox, and you can too. I think by then they had no illusion that there are no other places where smallpox is kept, but they felt that it would be a very important public ethical and moral statement to make, and that there was no good justifiable reason for keeping the smallpox virus around for scientific research when it is so dangerous to people.
So the final deadline of June 30th, 2002 passed a few months ago. What happened regarding that deadline? Did it mean anything finally?
Well, in the end, what happened was that there was a reconsideration for the reasons why smallpox virus, the real McCoy, should be kept around in labs in the U.S. and in Russia. And the justification is that the vaccine is the traditional vaccine that was invented in 1796. It's 18th century biotechnology. And genetic engineering is moving very fast. And it's quite conceivable that a strain of smallpox could suddenly appear in a terrorist attack or even in a laboratory accident with a weapons lab that would not be stoppable with the traditional vaccine. Therefore, there would need to be alternatives for stopping smallpox, namely antiviral drugs. We now know that antiviral drugs can work pretty well on the HIV virus, so why not smallpox? And a better modern vaccine. But in order to have these things, the Food and Drug Administration requires testing of the real thing. You have to take the real virus and you have to test somehow or other a drug on that virus to prove that the drug works. You can't take the drug and test it on some relative of smallpox. That's not acceptable to the FDA.
So what kind of tests are being done now on monkeys for improving the vaccine?
Well, there have been a series of protocols on real live monkeys at the CDC run by a team of researchers from the Army led by Dr. Peter Jarling. And they have managed, against, I think, most expectations, to actually infect monkeys with real live smallpox and make those monkeys look like they have smallpox.
Now, this is unusual because smallpox is supposed to only live in humans, not in other species.
Smallpox, yes, doesn't live naturally in any other species. And it's interesting because perhaps 10,000 years ago, the smallpox virus was an emerging virus like HIV or Ebola coming out of some unknown animal host somewhere in nature. And it made a trans-species jump into humans. This is what viruses do. It's one of the main strategies for survival of a virus. It can change hosts dramatically sometimes. In this case, the original host of smallpox is unknown, and the virus apparently is no longer able to infect even its original host. In fact, the original host may be extinct. So the Army people went ahead, and they found that by really loading the monkeys with smallpox, giving a monkey the equivalent of about 100 million human lethal doses of smallpox, they could simulate the disease. The disease comes on full-blown in a monkey if you do that. And the monkey postulates. The monkey can die. The monkey even can develop hemorrhagic-type smallpox. It's gruesome work. And then the idea, eventually, I think, is going to be to test drugs and vaccines on these monkeys and to prove that you can save the monkey's life that way.
How much progress are these researchers making in developing a better smallpox vaccine?
I think that the progress is looking very good. We certainly are not there yet. But I also would like to give people a sense of reassurance here that, you know, the problems that we have, the threat that we have from smallpox is a threat that's coming out of biology labs in other places. And probably one very good way to deal with that threat is through biology itself. And the research is promising. I think it's very likely that we will have at some point a drug that really does work on smallpox. That will be a very good thing, and the sooner the better. And I think it also is quite possible now to have an extremely good vaccine on smallpox that's milder and that may work just as well.
Richard Preston's new book about smallpox and anthrax is called The Demon in the Freezer. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Richard Preston, author of the new book, The Demon in the Freezer, about smallpox and anthrax, and what scientists are currently doing to protect us against their use as terrorist weapons. On Friday, the nation's top health officials suggested a smallpox vaccine strategy that would begin by immunizing healthcare workers, then make the vaccine available to the general public. The vaccine is unlikely to be licensed for general use until 2004. When we left off, Richard Preston was talking about how scientists are working on improving the smallpox vaccine. I know one of the fears now is that terrorists could be using a genetically altered form of smallpox that might be resistant to the vaccine. The vaccine might not prevent somebody from catching a genetically engineered strain of smallpox. Can scientists work in advance of knowledge of what the genetically altered strain would look like and come up with a vaccine that could vanquish a strain that they don't even know what it is yet?
This is a great question. Probably, but we don't know. Genetic engineering is the wild card, and genetic engineering has gotten to be really easy. And I spent time in labs with people doing actual engineering of viruses to see how it's done. Today, you can engineer a virus, a new virus, for peaceful research for probably less than $1,000 in lab materials. And you do it through the help of something called a virus engineering kit, which can be ordered through the internet for about $200. That's the way scientists get the stuff. And virus engineering now is considered to be so routine that many senior scientists find it rather tedious and boring, and so they turn the work over to graduate students or even summer interns. We're not talking about rocket science here. And it's quite clear to me that Iraqi scientists or many scientists in other countries can do this kind of work just as easily as anybody else. Recently, within the last couple of years, there's been some surprising and I think maybe scary research that was developed originally in Australia, where a group inadvertently put a certain gene into the mousepox virus and found that they'd created a kind of killer virus that could overwhelm the mouse's immunity. Now, mousepox is not infective in humans, but it's very closely related to smallpox. So the concern was that if you took this single gene and you put it into smallpox, you might have a vaccine-proof virus, which would the scientists themselves refer to as a super variola. Variola is the scientific name of smallpox. So a superpox or a super variola that could get around the vaccine. And this type of work might be done in a relatively simple lab for a cost of materials of about the price of a used car.
What are the odds that we could do something before we knew what that strain was?
Well, I spent some time with scientists in a lab in St. Louis. One of them was a virologist named Dr. Nanhai Chen. And I watched him while he engineered strains of this type of virus and tested them in mice to see what would happen to try to develop a vaccine strategy that would work. And he remarked to me, he said to me at one point, you know, I think you could learn how to do this yourself in about 2 months. But what they found out was that there probably are ways to vaccinate people against this type of genetically engineered smallpox. And furthermore, a good smallpox drug would probably attack the virus in ways that you couldn't engineer around by adding genes to the virus. So there are ways to deal with it. But it is necessary for scientists to go forward and do this.
You know, in thinking about the possible weaponization of smallpox, I just keep asking myself, how stupid can you be? Because if you're in one part of the world and you're sending your smallpox weapon to another part of the world, it's going to come back to your part of the world eventually. It's a disease that spreads. Once the cat's let out of that bag, it's not going to just stay in one place. So any terrorist who uses that is hurting his or her own people in the long run. So I keep asking myself, who could possibly unleash this, no matter how evil or perverse they are?
Indeed, and that goes right to the question of human nature. But we should not forget that in the Soviet Union, Soviet biologists developed genetically engineered strains of plague or black death, which is highly contagious in the air, and they made the kind that can't be treated with antibiotics. And then they allegedly put it in missiles aimed at various targets, perhaps in the United States. And there was no consideration there that it might get back to Russia. That's the way the thinking goes. And the fact of the matter is that a weapon doesn't have to be used in order to be extremely powerful. The hydrogen bomb is a very effective weapon.
That's the whole deterrence strategy.
It's intimidating, and it changes the balance of power. Now, if the United States government thinks that Iraq has genetically engineered smallpox, then that changes the equation of power as these two countries, the United States and Iraq, maneuver toward a war.
Does the United States think Iraq has genetically engineered smallpox?
I really don't know. You know, again and again, as I was researching this book, I came up across the question of what's classified. And when you're interviewing people who clearly have security clearances and access to classified stuff, you find all of a sudden that the interview goes dead. Because they're not even allowed to tell you that there's something classified here that you're getting onto. But what happens is that you end up with shadow shapes. If you interview enough people, you begin to see the shapes of classified things by where the interview stops. And by that way, you get a feel, a kind of gut feel for what's believed by the intelligence services of the U.S. And I can tell you that the shadow or the shape that I'm seeing is that they really don't know whether Iraq has genetically engineered smallpox, but it's just so darned easy, apparently, that one has to proceed on the assumption that probably. There is also another rather disturbing and dark shadow shape, and that's the one in the Russian Federation. There appear to be two military labs in Russia. One is called Sergeyev Posad or Zagorsk, and the other one is called Pokrov, and both are near Moscow. Both have been totally closed to outside inspection. Both are believed or known to have had large stocks of smallpox virus in them as recently as 10 or 11 years ago. And nobody knows what's going on there today, and the Russian Federation is completely stonewalling outside inspectors. And the shape that I see or sense is that Russia today has at least one strain of smallpox that is vaccine resistant, maybe super lethal, but may not be genetically engineered. It may just be a really hot natural strain that Soviet scientists collected somewhere.
My guest is Richard Preston. His new book, The Demon in the Freezer, is about smallpox and anthrax. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Richard Preston is my guest, and his new book, The Demon in the Freezer, is about smallpox and anthrax. His previous book was the bestseller, The Hot Zone, which was about Ebola. One of the difficult decisions facing the government and doctors now is, you know, should we start vaccinating the American public in case there's some kind of smallpox attack? Or should we just not do that and only do it if there really is an attack? One of the problems, apparently, is that a lot of people or an unacceptable number of people could die from the vaccination itself. What are some of the vulnerabilities that we have with the actual vaccination?
The vaccine is pretty potent stuff. It's actually a live virus called vaccinia, which is mild in most people. But when you become infected with vaccinia, you get a little pustule on your arm where they scratched your arm with it.
And a lot of us have scars on the side of our arm from when we got these vaccinations as kids.
Yes, it's a little scar on your upper arm about the size of a dime or a nickel. That means you were successfully vaccinated, but the vaccine wears off starting about 5 years later, so such folks aren't no longer probably very immune to it. So some unknown number of people can become very sick with this virus. People who have compromised immune systems because of chemotherapy, being HIV positive, having a history of eczema. And
why eczema?
I'm not really sure why, but eczema is a skin disease, and it's, I believe, an autoimmune type disorder. And these pox viruses, of which the vaccinia is another type of pox, they're life forms. They're really actually extremely interesting. The way they succeed in taking over and multiplying in their host is they confuse the immune system. They throw off all kinds of proteins and enzymes that make your immune system go haywire. By the way, that's believed what the mechanism of smallpox killing a human being is, something along those lines, that the virus causes something called a cytokine storm in the body. This is a complete derangement of the immune system. Your immune system essentially goes into crash mode, and the virus then is able to multiply unopposed. With the case of the vaccine, the virus can sometimes multiply unopposed in a person if their immune system is a little bit off. This is the worry. So should we be vaccinating people now? It seems to me that it would be logical to at least begin some limited program of vaccination with healthcare and emergency people. Then the government could get some experience in what happens and how to deal with it. And there are going to be problems that are going to crop up. But with experience and practice comes knowledge, and that could help everyone later.
How much of a stock of vaccine do we have? Like, if the government decided to vaccinate the American public, would there be enough vaccine to do it?
Oh, I think there is, actually, right now. And I think there's going to be even more. There's a company that's making large quantities of the vaccine very rapidly. It's a British-American company based in Massachusetts. And what I heard was that the factory there in Massachusetts was surrounded by military security. And the vaccine, as it comes off the line and is verified and tested, is being dispersed to secret locations around the United States, probably military airfields, where it can be flown quickly into a city or a place where there's an emergency. So, there's probably enough vaccine. Whether the vaccine could be gotten quickly into people, if you think about this just in your own community, what if doctors in the local hospital had to vaccinate 100,000 people all at once within a week or so? What would they do? There isn't really any plan. And it would be, you know, a very chaotic and frightening time if, heaven forbid, smallpox were ever to break out. In my gut, I don't feel that doomsday is coming. And I have faith that particularly we as Americans, we have an incredible natural ingenuity, and we have a resourcefulness and a flexibility to deal with things as they come along. And I have no doubt that this country can handle an outbreak of smallpox. No doubt at all about that.
You've talked about this a little bit, but I certainly get the impression from reading your book that the experts know more than they're telling us. One example that you allude to is a secret meeting held by leaders of the National Institute of Health that was held in April of 2002. What do you know about that meeting?
Well, what I heard about that meeting from someone who was there was that it was a meeting of experts in the spread of infectious disease. And these are people who use computers and models to try to model how things spread. And they were given the assignment to model the spread of smallpox in the modern world, to find out whether various strategies of vaccination, such as the ring vaccination strategy that was used so successfully during the eradication, would work. And in true scientific style, the experts disagreed with one another, as they always do. And the bottom line was that they couldn't agree on what smallpox would do in the modern world, but many members, maybe the majority, felt that it would really be bad and that the virus could spread very rapidly from a very small number of cases. So I've heard statements such as, if a terror attack resulted in, say, 10 cases of smallpox in a city like New York, that it might be necessary to quickly vaccinate 40 million people in order to have a hope of stopping the outbreak. The other concern that one has, of course, is that even if the United States is protected with a stockpile of the vaccine, and even if the vaccine is effective and does work, the rest of the world has very little or no protection. The World Health Organization, some years ago, having decided that smallpox had been eradicated, destroyed its entire stocks of the vaccine in order to save about $25,000 a year in electricity costs for freezers that were holding the vaccine. And today, the World Health Organization stockpile of the vaccine is one dose for every 12,000 people on Earth. That is completely nothing. And if the virus were to get going in countries such as Bangladesh, in Africa, in places, in Asia where the human population is large, there could be a really significant mortality.
The technique for eradicating smallpox was this technique of vaccinating a ring of people around where the disease was. So that was, as you described, almost like a firewall of immunity around the disease. It seems to me that would be really hard to create now because there's so much jet travel in and out of places that you can vaccinate people in a ring around the epicenter of the disease. But unless there's an enormous quarantine program, people are going to be coming and going, inside and outside of that ring.
The incubation period of smallpox is about 11 to 12 days, and it runs like clockwork. The incubation period is the time when you have the virus in your body, but you don't have any symptoms and don't feel sick at all. How many Americans can answer the question, where will you be in the next 11 or 12 days? Many will answer that they're going to be somewhere else during that period of time, and some will be traveling to foreign countries, and they will be traveling to different states and in and out of cities, commuters, and so on. Ring vaccination worked in rural societies, in peasant societies, when people didn't travel. And also when people knew there was smallpox, and then they would become very frightened, and the village would basically shut down. And in Africa, in rural Africa, for example, people practice what is known as reverse quarantine, where if it was known that smallpox was in the area, people would close their villages to the outside world. They would just shut the village off.
And that would be really difficult to do now in an area like the United States.
It's almost unimaginable.
You've said that you wanted the tone of your new book, The Demon in the Freezer, about smallpox and anthrax, to just be straightforward. You know, you're not trying to be alarmist or sensationalist or to underplay the problem either, to just kind of present things the way you understand them. It seems to me this is a kind of issue that probably scientists and politicians are having to deal with a lot right now. How should they portray the possibility of bioweapons? What kind of words should they use? How dramatic should they make it? How frightening or should they make it seem, or how much should they allay people's fears? Did you get any winds of that, like, inside conversation about what language to use? What kind of issues are they facing about that?
My sense of it is that the public officials who are aware of this problem and really think about it are probably more alarmed than they let on with the public. If you're an elected official or a government person, you really don't want to just be out there scaring the public, and you want to make sure that people understand that you've got things under control because, after all, you're in authority. So, you find people saying, let's everybody calm down and let's be rational about this, and that's exactly the right thing to do. But I'm coming out of it from a different point of view. I'm trying to tell the story as it really is. And if it's scary, well, it's scary. But it shouldn't be just alarming. It also should be interesting. And what I find is that even when you're talking about these horrible viruses and so on, that they are a work of nature. They're nature. We're the human species. And we have to get along with nature somehow. And we also have to understand nature. And when you really understand nature, it almost always ends up being quite aesthetically beautiful. And many virus experts have said to me that they find viruses aesthetically incredibly beautiful, even when they think about what it does to the human body, even when they think about the suffering and death that a virus can cause. There is also a kind of stark and elemental beauty to viruses that is like watching a lion make a kill. It may be horrible, but it is the universe.
I think the movie was called Outbreak. Is that right? The movie with Dustin Hoffman that seemed mm-hmm. to be either based or loosely based on your Ebola book, The Hot Zone. I'm not sure whether it was officially based on that or not.
The movie Outbreak was unofficially based on The Hot Zone. It was inspired by The Hot Zone, I think is what they said.
Uh-huh. So you had no hand in it?
No, not really.
I wonder what you thought of that movie and whether you thought it... I didn't see it, so I have no opinion. But I wonder if you thought it sensationalized anything or was more frightening than it needed to be or whatever.
Well, I thought it had a very strong opening, but then it weakened up. The problem with many virus movies, maybe all of them, is that Hollywood always demands a cure for the virus at the end. In this case, we had to cure Renee Russo, who was dying of Ebola virus. She was dying beautifully of Ebola, by the way. And how to do that? Well, Peter Jarling, you know, who's the Army scientist who is featured in both these books, he was at home and his telephone rang at 3 o'clock in the morning and there was a familiar voice on the line. Dr. Peter Jarling, this is Dustin Hoffman. I'm on location out in Hawaii right now and the script is terrible and we can't figure out how to end this movie. You got to tell us, how can we cure Ebola virus? We got to do it fast because Rene Russo is dying. So, you know, he answered. Meanwhile, Peter's wife got silently on the other end of the line and was listening away to this conversation with Dustin Hoffman, and she thought it was really cool. So at any rate, Peter said, well, okay, what you could do is you could cure it with monoclonal antibodies. And, well, how do you make them? Well, and he told them how to make them. And the ending of the movie, everybody gets cured with this IV bag that looks like it's filled with Tang.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Richard Preston's new book about smallpox and anthrax is called The Demon in the Freezer. This is Fresh Air.